Jedi going crazy thing in the first place. Right again. Perhaps you'll tell me my name next, or who my sister is. Luke's voice held no irritation, just mild amusement. He was trying to figure out what Ben was getting at. Ben continued.
So, I'm thinking that the best way to understand something is to learn about it.
Ah, now I see where you're going with this.
Well, you wanted to master the Haas Ador, even when the Baron Dos Sages were leery of teaching you,
Ben offered.
Even when they thought it might turn you into another Kydus.
True enough. Ben waited, but Luke offered nothing further. He waited longer, patiently, but still no more words came. So he tried again.
It's not a dark side ability per se, Ben said. Not exclusively. It isn't inherently a harmful thing, like force lightning or force grip. I mean, you can't even really change anything substantial from what I understand. And Jedi are already able to look into the future a little bit. That's why our reflexes are so sharp and fast.
We use the Force to do that.
And don't you use the Force to flow walk?
True, but... Ben, it's not what you're imagining it to be like.
You don't know what I'm imagining.
I bet I've got a good idea, because believe it or not, I was once 16, and I know what I would think it was like, Luke said, a smile softening what was starting to develop into an argument.
But you were a very young 16,
Ben said with a slight touch of arrogance.
Also true,
Luke admitted readily, chuckling softly. Even so, some things are universal. I don't think I want you learning flow walking, Ben. He held up a hand as Ben opened his mouth to protest.
No, wait, hear me out. It's not because I don't think you're strong enough to use it wisely, but because...
He stopped suddenly. Ben inhaled swiftly, his green eyes flying wide open. They were everywhere. Dozens. No, hundreds of them. They emerged from every nook and cranny on the suddenly ominously dark vessel, squeezing up from hairline cracks, flooding out from under chairs and consoles. Their legs were waving frantically, and they moved with astonishing speed up the chair, across his boots, up the legs of his pants.
I see them too, Luke said. His voice was completely calm.
Nothing but hallucinations, Ben. Remember what we talked about. Ben did remember, but it was difficult to focus on remembering that these were simple mind tricks when he could feel the vaping things crawling up his legs and arms. He closed his eyes and took a deep breath, falling back on logic when his mind kept feeling those myriad tiny legs scurrying across his skin. For one thing, such a profusion of arachnids would have been noticed immediately during the pre-flight check. And even if somehow this many living things got missed both by technology and human eyes, he would be able to sense them in the Force now, and he couldn't. For another, the ship couldn't even contain them all. All logic concluded that the spiders did not exist. The thoughts, calming and settling, flitted across his brain in less than a second. He opened his eyes, and of course, saw nothing. He turned and met his father's approving gaze.
Good job, son. What did you see?
Spiders, Ben said.
Me too. The adrenaline was fading now. The meditation, even as brief as it had been, had sent calming endorphins through Ben's system.
It seems kind of odd that the hallucinations are so universal, you know? Why not something more specifically tailored to the individual? I mean, there are a lot of things that rattle me more than a bunch of spiders.
As he spoke, he thought back to the several nights he'd spent on Xyost a few years earlier, of the voices, first in dreams and then when he was awake, telling him to do horrible things, leading him to want to do them. He also thought of the torture that his cousin had put him through, attempting to temper him like a piece of metal. Oh yes, there were a lot of things scarier than a ship full of bugs.
I'm not sure. We'd have to study the type of radiation we're being bombarded with, and the effects it has on human chemistry. It's possible that it simply activates a basic primal fear center. Spider bites could be deadly on a primitive world. Strange creatures hovering around us could be too. Fear is a logical reaction.
But bugs, Dad?
squish. End of problem.
Luke gave his son a glance. Still scared you at first, though, didn't it? Ben felt his face grow hot. Not for the first time, he cursed the pale, freckled skin he had inherited from his mother.
I was just surprised, that's all. Now that I know what to expect, I won't be.
Luke shrugged. We know the spiders and the mysterious beings are typical hallucinations. They might not be the only ones. We should be cautious. Anything distressing, out of the ordinary, we shouldn't automatically assume it's real.
Agreed.
Ben decided not to try to pick up where they had been interrupted on the conversation about flow walking. He did not think he was in a strong position to argue that he was ready to learn such a discipline when he'd just been taken aback, even momentarily, by an illusionary bunch of spiders. They continued on for several hours, carefully planning short jumps. Luke's hasse-à-dur technique proved consistently useful, although it did seem to drain him. Ben started to get a sense for navigating the corridors, extending himself in the forest to assist his father in determining which way felt right in a place where everything was constantly changing. The series of short jumps that sometimes felt like one step forward, two steps back, eventually led them to planets. The concentration of corridors was greatest here. It was what permitted life to evolve at all. But each planet proved to be a disappointment. What life there was primitive and stunted, and a sick suspicion rose in Ben. He was reluctant to voice it, but he knew he had to.
Dad, he ventured at one point, what if we're completely wrong?
I'm always prepared to entertain that suggestion, Luke said. The universe is nothing if not humbling. What do you think we might be wrong about?
Well, everything we have says that the Angti live inside the Kaithal Rift. But what if they don't? What if everyone is just assuming that?
Good question. But you taught me the importance of following the evidence, remember? If everything points to them being here, clearly this is the first place we should look.
Well, yeah, under normal circumstances, said Ben. But looking around, here is not good for the Jade Shadow or her crew.
Luke eyed him. That's true. Do you have a better suggestion?
No.
Ben was inordinately pleased that Luke freely admitted that he, Ben, had taught him something. He was less pleased that he hadn't been able to come up with a better idea.
I guess we follow the evidence.
Luke grinned.
Then let's be about it. It'll take as long as it takes. After all, Ben, we've got a decade to kill.
Ben grimaced. This time, Luke let him plot the jump, checking to make sure Ben had calculated properly. The planet they found, though, could be almost immediately ruled out. Ben took a break to eat and drop into a healing meditation for about 20 minutes. Then he and his father traded off. Luke rose from the pilot's seat, and Ben slipped into it. His dad patted his shoulder as he headed back to the galley to get a bite to eat. Ben didn't like to admit it, but he was starting to get bored. He refocused his attention on what he was doing, because he was wise enough to know that when you got bored, you got careless. And when you got careless, bad things often happened. He was refreshed, fed, and alert, and his mind wasn't wandering. But he really, really wished they'd hurry up and find the Angti. Despite Luke's quip earlier, and despite the beauty of the rift, he didn't want to spend the next several years hopping from corridor to corridor. Suddenly, there came a harsh beeping sound. The lights on the console began chasing one another around like lampflies in summer. The vessel began to shake, but there was no storm.
What the?
Yelped Ben. He stabbed at the controls, damping down a quick spike of fear and harnessing the adrenaline to sharpen his reflexes instead. But his reflexes suddenly didn't matter. He was staring at readings that told him that he was not inside the Kaithal Rift, but in orbit around Coruscant. A blink of an eye later, the readings insisted that the ship was in imminent danger of tearing itself apart. Then they were picking up signs of a ship that wasn't there. Another illusion. Ben almost smiled to himself. Maybe this was what happened in the Rift. The hallucination started out as generic and became more and more specific. Although the whole Coruscant thing was kind of stupid, because Ben knew good and well that... Luke came racing back from the galley, dropped into the co-pilot seat, and began swiftly, but with control, to bring the Jade Shadow back in line. Ben felt him extend his senses in the Force, and the ship seemed to quiet, almost like a living animal responding to the calmness of its master.
"Oh," Ben said. "That wasn't a hallucination."
"No," Luke said, his blue eyes narrowing as he gazed at the readings. "Although I can see how you thought it was. On the screen was a reading of Tatooine. Then there was that ship." There was a sudden bright flash, and the ship that appeared on the reading was right in front of them. It was huge. It had come out of nowhere. It was discordant, and it was directly on top of them. For an instant, Ben was reminded of the Yuuzhan Vong ships. But if their vessels were organic in a plant-based fashion, this was living stone. It was a sphere, sort of, but nothing so precise. Strange projections jutted out. Exhaust ports? Thruster ports? Seemingly at random. It was covered with thick hull plates that were etched with some kind of writing or symbols, and it was moving steadily toward them.
"Well, Ben, looks like we can stop searching. The Ang-Ti have found us."
It had to be. The Sanhedrin ships could move from one place to another in the blink of an eye, and clearly, they had the ability to affect or confuse readings. As he started to think more clearly, Ben realized that what he'd seen had been stored images and information on the planets, not actual live readings.
"When you can't trust your eyes," Luke said, and Ben finished for him.
"Trust the Force."
Ben softened his gaze and dropped into a receptive state, extending his feelings and senses out into the Force that had once so frightened him and was now such a source of strength, knowledge, and even comfort. It took a while, and he kept part of his attention on the enormous ship in front of them. It made no attempt to contact or fire upon them, but neither did it move away. Ben was certain that the Ang-Ti were watching them as surely as he and Luke were watching their ship. And then, Ben felt them. They were like no other energy he had ever encountered in the Force. They felt shifting, weaving in and out of the Force, like they were not really part of it, although Ben knew that all living things were part of the Force. They were there, and they were not, and they managed both at the same time. And holding that contradiction in his mind was starting to give Ben a headache. He felt his father reaching out, a strong, clear, bright, calm presence in the Force. There were no words, but Luke was open and inviting. Luke was still as stone, his eyes, like Ben's, open, seeing and also focusing inward. The response all but took the wind out of him, so powerful was it. There was a definite sense of, not hostility, but not wanting. They were not welcome, but neither were they being repulsed. Yet. They were to be tested. They must prove themselves. There was a hint of softening, and Ben realized that somehow the Ang-Ti knew why they had come, and would at least give them the chance to speak. The softening suddenly turned hard, cold. Ben knew that if they failed the test, they would be refused, and he got a definite sense that that refusal would not be anything pleasant. He felt his father agree. And then Luke took a deep breath. Ben felt him withdraw from the Force as a conscious presence. He still sensed Luke. He would always be able to sense him, unless Luke himself deliberately chose otherwise. Just as Ben sometimes chose not to be present in the Force, he too withdrew and ground a palm into his tired eyes.
"You agreed to their test," he said.
"I don't really think there was a choice, Ben."
"I don't either. But how do..."
Their screen blinked. Coordinates suddenly appeared on it.
"Never mind," Luke said. "Let's go."
Chapter 14. Aboard the Jade Shadow.
After all the struggling, guesswork, and sheer teeth-rattling endurance Ben and Luke had suffered through over the last several days, their current situation had a definite air of relief about it. Soon after Luke had conveyed his agreement to the Ang-Ti's proposal, coordinates had begun scrolling across the screen. It was a series of jumps that proved to be shockingly easy. On the third jump, Ben said,
"You know, we should have been able to figure these out on our own."
Luke replied mildly, seems to me that we've spent several days attempting to do precisely that, and that the jumps we're now executing had not occurred to either of us. Besides, we had no specific direction. We were simply trying to cast our net as wide as possible. Ben sighed.
I know. I just feel a little foolish. It's so obvious now that I look at it.
Things are usually obvious when you're on the other side of them, Luke replied. Also, if we had arrived unexpectedly in orbit around the Angti homeworld, we might well have been attacked and killed before we could even present our case properly. Ben threw up his hands in surrender, laughing.
You win. I don't know why you needed to hire Noir Aven. You argue a case well enough on your own.
Both fell silent, though, when after the final jump, they found themselves orbiting not a planet full of sentient beings, but a small, uninhabited moon.
Dad, Ben said slowly, do you think we just walked into a trap?
Luke shook his blonde head.
No. If they wanted to kill us, they had a perfect opportunity to do so earlier. I'd hoped that the test would be conducted on their homeworld, but apparently this is the site they've selected.
Ben touched the controls. The moon was rocky and inhospitable.
It has an oxygen-nitrogen atmosphere, which is good, although the oxygen is a bit lower than ideal. And we're not entirely protected from the EMR of the rift. But the Hassat door technique should keep us safe enough,
he said with just a touch of uncertainty.
Will we need breath masks?
No, thank goodness. We should be all right outside the shadow for a few hours. And there's a single life form, Mammalian.
Our welcoming party, said Luke, who will no doubt be the one administering the challenge. The surface was as rocky as it had appeared from space. As they maneuvered the shadow in for a landing, still following the extremely precise coordinates they had been given, they saw the Angti vessel. The ship was clearly of the same make as the Sanhedrin ship that had confronted them earlier, but on a smaller, more personal scale. It still looked unsettlingly organic to Ben. There were similar protrusions extending from its ovoid, but he could see no doors or ramps, nor was there any sign of the Angti representative they had anticipated would greet them. Ben and Luke exchanged glances.
Maybe it will disembark once we show good faith, Luke suggested.
I hope so. This is all feeling pretty weird.
I'm afraid I have to agree. Luke settled the shadow on the rocky soil, near but not too close to their host's vessel. Ben reached for his cloak. After all that time spent on Doran lugging around a breath mask and assorted canisters, he wanted to take only the minimum he'd need.
Leave the lightsaber, Luke said, already unfastening his own. We're not coming anticipating a fight.
What if they give us one?
The Force will give us enough to rely on if we have to defend ourselves.
But Ben, this is the species that Yoda sent a man to for healing. I don't think this challenge is to the death.
Ben wasn't so sure.
Yeah, and they sometimes appear out of nowhere and ram ships, too.
But he left his lightsaber behind as his father wished. Ben felt slightly lightheaded the moment they stepped down the ramp, but the sensation wasn't extreme. They approached slowly, giving the Angti plenty of time to exit his own vessel. Several large gray rocks were clustered within a few meters of the ship. Ben wondered why the Angti had chosen such a landing site, when a few hundred meters to the north there was a large area that was completely clear. Luke slowed the pace even further the closer they drew. He frowned a little, revealing that he was as puzzled as Ben.
Perhaps this is part of the challenge, he murmured slightly.
And then, one of the rocks near the ship moved. It uncurled slowly, languidly, extending a long tail, two powerful lower limbs, two smaller forelegs, and a large head on a sinuous neck. It fixed them with large, dark, unblinking eyes as it curled its tail beneath it and sank back on its hind legs. Ben instinctively knew that the slow revelation of its presence was deliberate and for their benefit. This creature could probably transform from appearing to be a simple rock formation to a deadly threat in a heartbeat. Even now that it was not curled up, but rather sitting, it still blended in with its environment. It was much more imposing than the holographic image Ben had studied. Something about its plating and its stillness was unsettling. Ben glanced at his father. Luke bowed politely, and Ben followed suit.
I am Jedi Luke Skywalker. This is my son Ben. Thank you for being willing to meet with us. We have come as requested to accept your challenge.
Ben and Luke waited. The being did not move. Ben took in the geometric designs on certain pieces of the jointed plating that covered its body. He recognized a few of them as being the same as some of those he had seen on the Sanhedrin ship. This close to the creature, he could see now that the patterns were not simply painted on, but were etched into the Angti's shell, and then stained. Ben wondered if it had hurt, or if, as it appeared, the plating was more like armor or some kind of exoskeleton than like skin.
I don't think he understands basic, Dad,
Ben said quietly after a few minutes.
Doesn't look like it, no.
Ben glanced at the vessel.
They seem to be highly advanced technologically, and we know that they've been able to communicate with humans before. So why is he not making use of his equipment? How's he supposed to tell us what our challenge is?
Luke smiled slightly.
Because I'm willing to bet that our challenge is to figure out a way to communicate with them without the use of technology, which is going to be a fine challenge indeed, as the Yang-Ti communicate among themselves by tasting, smelling, and touching one another with their tongues, he added. As if it had heard and completely understood everything that had been said, the stone-still creature suddenly opened its mouth. 6 thin, bright green tendrils shot out and flickered about wildly.
Oh, gross, said Ben.
Then he wondered if the Angti actually had been able to understand everything they had said, and he blushed a little. The Angti withdrew its glistening green tongues and was as still as if it had never moved at all.
How are we supposed to learn that kind of language?
Ben asked, his voice slightly sharp. He would have died before admitting it, but the sudden movement of the previously motionless being, particularly when the movement involved green tongues, had startled him.
We don't,
Luke said quietly. His gaze was locked with the dark, shiny, fist-sized orbs of the Angti.
We don't learn his language, and he doesn't learn ours. But we have to communicate.
Ben blinked.
Wait a minute. How do you know it's a he?
The same way I intend to communicate with him, Luke replied. His voice was softer, slightly deeper, and although he was still regarding the Angti, Ben realized that his father wasn't really seeing the being. Luke took several steps forward, closing the space between himself and the Angti, and then eased himself to the rocky ground to sit facing it. Him. And then Ben got it. Without another word, he followed his father's example, moving to sit cross-legged beside Luke, turning his face up, for even seated the Angti was taller than they, to the alien. He let his gaze soften, but did not close his eyes, and slowed his breathing despite the thinness of the atmosphere. He felt a touch on his hand, and turned it so that his father and he were clasping hands. Luke needed physical contact if he was to extend the Hossot door technique to protect both himself and Ben. Ben wasn't accustomed to holding hands with his dad, but he felt a slight tingling and was grateful for the shielding Luke was offering. He sensed his father in the Force immediately, of course. Luke Skywalker was a bright, shining presence to anyone who was Force-sensitive, and his bond with Ben enabled the youth to connect with him at once. Ben did not sense the being before him, and wondered if the Yang-Ti knew the same technique for masking his presence in the Force as he, Ben, knew. He felt a little puzzled. He was certain his father had gotten it right, but if this being truly wanted to communicate with them in the Force, then why the... And then, suddenly, he was there, shining as bright as Luke Skywalker, but in an entirely different way. Tadar Roe, for suddenly Ben knew his name, was a completely different type of Force user than any Ben had ever encountered. His presence felt splintered somehow, but not in a negative way. This was not a splintering caused by being broken, but by choice, by design. It was as if Tadar Roe's Force self was a sort of fabric, woven of many threads, and he was now permitting the Skywalkers to see and comprehend this. Ben had felt it when people's life essences had winked out of the Force. He was accustomed to the sickening sensation. He had been told that his namesake, Obi-Wan Ben Kenobi, had staggered and
appeared faint when Alderaan had been blown to bits by the Death Star. So many deaths all at once had to have been traumatic. What Ben experienced now, though, while overwhelmingly intense, was not horrifying. Not at all. He realized his breathing had speeded up, and that the air that he was sucking into his lungs wasn't quite doing the trick, and the shimmering, many-stranded being that was Tadar Ro had somehow gotten a hold of him and the Force, and... He had no option. Ben abruptly withdrew from the Force and slammed the door shut. He realized he was sweating heavily and shaking. He turned to look at his father, who lifted a hand in a dismissive yet gentle gesture.
"Go back to the shadow, Ben," Luke said. He was still gazing raptly at Tadar Ro. "I'll be there soon."
Ben felt his face flush a second time. He hadn't been able to handle it. Whatever it was. He rose and walked back to the ship. As he started to ascend the ramp, he turned and looked back to see Tadar Ro's long, thin green tongues flickering and caressing his father's upturned face. Ben was glad to return to the more familiar, comfortable artificial atmosphere of his mother's ship. Once back on board, though, he threw himself into his studies of the Ang-Ti as sort of a penance for what he had perceived as a failure, only to realize how very little specific information there actually was. He therefore amused himself with a holodrama, embarrassed that he was doing such a thing, but too agitated to bestir himself to do anything else. He was lying back in the flowform chair, going over what he had experienced with one part of his mind and observing the acting with the other, when he heard the door slide open and Luke's voice calling him. "Ben?" Ben turned off the holodrama quickly.
"Dad! How did it go? What was he doing? I'm sorry I couldn't..."
"You did just fine," Luke said reassuringly. "Even I've never experienced anything like what Tadar Ro tried to share with me."
He did look a bit drained, Ben thought. The knowledge mitigated his own feeling of falling short.
"Did you communicate with him in an acceptable way?"
Luke got a glass of water, gulped it down, refilled it, and dropped into the chair beside Ben. Ben seemed to notice, really notice, the creases in his father's face and the gray in his blonde hair. The fingers that curled around the glass were strong and calloused and knit. Luke Skywalker looked quite mortal at the moment, and Ben realized that the revelation made him uneasy. Then he thought about how wiped out he'd felt after a much shorter stay in the thin atmosphere, and convinced himself his father was just fine. Almost.
"Yes, though it was quite exhausting."
"They're a very alien species, aren't they?" Ben said.
Luke chuckled slightly and took another swig of water.
"Very. It's absolutely fascinating. I can see why Jason was so intrigued by them. They're like no other species I've ever met."
"So," Ben asked with fake casualness, "are we going to have the opportunity to meet more of them, or am I going to be stuck watching second-rate holodramas while we head on to the next possible clue?"
"Let me put it this way," Luke said. "Get used to being licked."
Chapter 15. Aboard the Jade Shadow.
"It's not telepathy, is it?"
Ben inquired, as he plotted out the jump according to the information Tadar Ro had transmitted to the Jade Shadow.
"No, but there's more of an understanding of specifics than you and I are accustomed to experiencing when we touch someone through the Force," Luke said. "And it seemed to be enough for them to understand basic."
"But how are they going to talk to us?" Ben inquired. "I mean, those tongues don't look like they'll operate the way ours do."
"Tadar Ro didn't seem to think there would be any problems once we arrived," Luke said.
Ben frowned a little. He knew that sometimes you simply needed to accept the way a circumstance was. But his father was sometimes so cryptic. Luke caught his expression and said,
"Don't look at me this time. That's as much as I know, too."
The jumps were easy and precise. Tadar Roe had given them directions as to not only where to jump, but also when. It had been calculated down to the second.
"So that's how they manage it," Ben said. "They know when it's safe to jump into one of the corridors. You think it has to do with flow walking?"
Ordinary Jedi could touch the future to a greater or lesser degree, enough to give them a slight edge in combat. But Ben was thinking about Gisela Horn, knowing exactly where the hidden security droids would emerge, and exactly when.
"Possibly," Luke said. "I'm sure we'll find out. Right now we need to focus on making those jumps."
Ben sighed inwardly. Luke was still obviously not ready to continue their interrupted discussion on flow walking. But he felt he was right. If Tadar Roe thought it useful to calculate the timing of the jump so precisely, they'd be wise to follow his instructions. They emerged from the last series of jumps to see a plane that was strikingly similar to the moon that Tadar Roe had selected for their challenge. The atmosphere was similar, but the EMR from the rift was slightly less, and there was at least life on this world. Ben could see bodies of water and patches of green here and there amid the stretches of rock.
"Well, we're here," he said. "Now what?"
As if in immediate answer, coordinates began flowing across the screen on the console.
"Set down there, and we'll find out," Luke said.
The habitations of the Ang-Ti were definitely recognizable as cities, but it was also immediately obvious that the beings they had come here to request aid from strove to be in harmony with their environment. Just as their bodies had evolved to blend in physically with the landscape, the Ang-Ti sought to have their cities do so as well. The landing site, located a short distance away from one of the smaller cities, was in a canyon, surrounded on all sides by steep, almost vertical stone walls. Luke was reminded of Tatooine as he regarded the forbidding landscape, harsh and inhospitable. The patches of green, fertile river valleys, were few and far between, and curiously seemed not to be where the Ang-Ti chose to dwell. It was as if these beings deliberately sought the harsher areas, as if the challenge was something they desired. If Tatooine was a hot desert world, this was a colder, rockier one. But as they descended and sped over machinery and homesteads, Luke recognized equipment that he immediately knew was designed to farm moisture. It was not quite the same machinery that he had grown up with, of course, but it was sufficiently similar. He sat with the conflicting emotions of nostalgia and unease for a moment, letting both flow through him. He sensed them all in the Force as they settled the Jade Shadow down on a rocky plateau. Accustomed as he was to experiencing the vast, luminous variety that was the presence of many lives, this staggered him for a moment. As he had said to Ben, there was something unique about the Ang-Ti presence in the Force. Tadar Roe was waiting for them. He stood with that inherent stillness as they lowered the ramp and disembarked from the shadow. In each foreclaw, he held a long, cylindrical metal object that flared to a rounded bulb at the end. A third device, a flat circle about the size of Luke's fist, was affixed to his chest. Small lights blinked and chased one another around the face of the circle. Luke and Ben approached him, nodded acknowledgement, and stood quietly, waiting. Tadar Roe held up one of the strange metal wands and indicated the bulb at the end, bringing it to his mouth, then handed it to Luke.
"It looks like a microphone of some sort," Ben said quietly.
Luke nodded, lifting the device to his mouth and watching Tadar Roe.
"Is this how we will be able to speak to you?" he said, holding the instrument up to his mouth as the Ang-Ti had indicated.
Tadar Roe's head bobbed up and down on his long, plated neck. It did not look like it was a natural gesture, but it was definitely a nod. He lifted his own wand to his mouth, opening his jaws and extending his tongues. Each one was capped with a small, glowing mechanism. They flickered over the end of the microphone.
"Yes," said Tadar Roe in a completely human, masculine voice.
The sound had a slight mechanical tinge to it, like a droid's, and it issued from the circular device on his chest rather than his now closed mouth. But it was unmistakably human, and Ben and Luke exchanged glances.
"We tended one of your species,"
His knowledge of your language enabled us to create this device so that we might speak with you.
I'm very glad of this, Luke said, speaking into the device. He was indeed quite relieved. He'd wondered how they would be able to bridge that barrier.
How does it work? Ben asked, peering at the device.
We communicate through pheromones,
Tadar Ro said.
It took time, but the device is able to analyze the pheromones we emit and find corresponding words in Basic for them. Now, you are expected. Follow.
He turned and began striding across the rocky ground at a brisk pace, heading for the single means of egress, a narrow tunnel through the sheer stone face. Luke and Ben broke into a trot to keep up with him. The thinner air of this planet made the short run harder than it should have been, and Luke found himself tapping into the force to enable his body to absorb more oxygen. Beside him, Ben was panting, just a little. As they emerged on the other side of the tunnel, Luke realized that the jagged rocks they were approaching were artificial constructs, the city he'd glimpsed from above. There was no structure to their arrangement. It appeared as random as if nature itself had created them. But there was a long, long line of motionless Ang-Ti, standing like the stone themselves and fixing the two strangers with their large, unblinking black eyes.
They will say something to you. Respond with the phrase the wounded one used,
Tadar Ro said.
As those who dwell beyond the veil will it.
Luke and Ben both nodded. Luke stepped up to the first Ang-Ti in line, observing that neither this one nor, as far as he could tell, any of the others held a translation device. This one was a very large male. His plating was chipped, and the geometric patterns etched on them were obviously very old. Sensing that this was a respected elder of the group, Luke bowed graciously. He waited for a name to come into his head, but it did not. Apparently Tadar Ro was the only one willing, so far, to disclose such information. Luke stood still as the Ang-Ti's tongues flickered over his face. It wasn't an unpleasant sensation. The tongues were not particularly wet, and the touch was light and gentle. Without the translation device, Luke had no idea what the being was saying, but he did not sense hostility, only the caution that an elder of a group would be wise to display. The elder retracted his tongues and stood waiting for Luke's reply. As those who dwell beyond the veil will it, Luke said, bowing slightly. He moved on to the next, also an elder, this one was female, and Luke got a very strong hit that she was not at all happy he was here. Beside him, out of the corner of his eye, he saw Ben flinch infinitesimally as the first elder's tongues danced across his features. Poor Ben. Luke wouldn't have appreciated the gesture when he was that age either, and he was proud of Ben, who endured it with only the vaguest ripple of discomfort in the force. The touch from the female elder's tongues was strangely cold. Not physically, but in the force. No, she was definitely not pleased that he and Ben were here. Nonetheless, he repeated the phrase with all the respect and courtesy he could summon, bowed and moved on. It took a long time, but at last Ben and Luke had officially introduced themselves to their new hosts. Some of them were welcoming, some hostile. Some entirely neutral in their attitudes. Luke wondered uneasily what he and Ben might have stumbled into, but he kept that thought carefully shuttered. When the last Ang-Ti had finished with Ben, the two Jedi turned to Tadar Ro. Tadar Ro beckoned them to follow him. Like the nod he had given the two Jedi previously, this seemed to be a forced gesture on his part, but one that was easily understood. They obeyed, following him as he took them around a large, jutting rock outcropping. Luke was surprised by what he saw on the other side. He hadn't been sure what to expect, but it wasn't this. Rather than another one of the rock-shaped dwellings, it was a small, single-story house, with four straight walls, a roof, and a door. While clearly constructed with materials native to the planet, also obviously designed for human aesthetics.
George Cardass, Ben said,
then realized he hadn't spoken into the translation mechanism. Taking it from Luke, he inquired,
This was George Cardass's home during the years he spent here, wasn't it?
Again, the nod.
Yes. We used what we learned of human needs and comforts and created this dwelling to accommodate him.
Luke pushed open the door. It was surprisingly cozy inside. A small mattress, lumpy looking but not uninviting, was nestled in a corner. A rug, woven of colorful dried fronds of some sort of plant, covered and insulated the floor. There were two tables, and one wall was filled with shelves. The floor, tables, and shelves were pleasantly cluttered with knick-knacks so familiar that Luke felt an unexpected tug on his heart. Repair parts for an astromech, spare parts for a blaster, data pads. Mixed in with these were colorful stones and carved wooden statuettes of various vaguely recognizable images. A small bantha, an astromech, and one he suspected was intended to be Tadar Ro. It had obviously been a hobby rather than a true artistic calling for Georges Cardass, whom Luke suspected of having many empty hours to while away.
Jedi may stay here, if they wish.
Thank you. We would like to visit here and perhaps stay here during the day. At night, though, we will return to our ship. Your atmosphere, while tolerable, is not ideal for us.
So Georges Cardass told us as well. Such is acceptable.
He indicated the mattress.
Sit. We will speak of why you have come, and what it is you expect to find here.
Luke and Ben sat on the mattress. As Luke had expected, it was fairly comfortable, if a little awkward to settle into.
You know why we have come, Luke said.
He'd been scrupulously polite, enduring all the face-licking and mystery, but now it was time for him to learn something from Tadar Ro, rather than the other way around.
I sense that not everyone here is as welcoming as you, Tadar Ro. Can you tell me why?
The being considered, then gave the forced nod.
It is best that you know. You are less likely to give offense.
Ben made a soft snorting noise, but thankfully, Luke thought, did not speak. Tadar Ro continued.
You have said you studied what Georges Cardass brought back of our people. Then you will know that for long and long, the Ang-Ti have believed that certain things are a certain way. We deeply respect the Force, but do not use it. Not the way others do. To us, it is a thing to be respected and experienced. It is not a tool, a weapon for us to use to make the universe what we wish it. We believe we are being guided. Events are not predetermined, but they flow gently to a certain place in a certain manner.
He was sitting back on his haunches, his tail tucked under him like a built-in chair. As he spoke, he moved his short forearms in a surprisingly graceful manner, the claws seeming to trace patterns in the air, and his eyes were half closed. Luke felt him even more strongly in the Force, and again wondered at these strange beings' relationship with it. Tadar Ro opened his eyes and his hands stilled, then lowered again to his chest.
So we have believed for long and long, but over the last few years, a prophet arose and spoke many things.
Do you believe in him? Luke asked. Do you think he prophesies truly?
It is such a strange concept to prophesy,
Tadar Ro replied, his voice, unnaturally created as it was, nonetheless conveying his confusion.
To think that events are so firm, like stone, rather than like wind and water and thought. And yet, he has seen things, and they have come to pass.
Coincidence or misinterpretation? Ben said at once. People hear what they want to hear. Keep it vague enough, and a prophecy or prediction will fit pretty much anything.
The young one speaks wisdom. And yet these are very specific. It could be, as you say, coincidence. Or it could be foreknowledge. The future is not unknown to my people.
No, it wouldn't be. Not to Flowwalkers, Luke thought. Could it be that the prophet simply has had good luck or good judgment in determining which of the possible futures will come to pass?
All these things you say we have thought of already. And yet, it is hard to discount what we have seen. As I have said, the prophet told us many things that later did come to pass. Specific, accurate things. In fact, everything he said happened, except for one final prophecy. He foretold the coming of those who dwell beyond the veil in his lifetime.
And that's really gotten the people upset, Ben said.
It has, indeed. Especially because a few weeks ago, the prophet became one with the Force, and we have had no sign of the coming of those who dwell beyond the veil.
Ben grimaced slightly and glanced at his father.
So it's been made apparent that he wasn't infallible then.
Tadar Ro made an odd ducking motion with his head, and Luke sensed his agitation.
His death has thrown my people into an uproar. We have become divided. We, who never had schisms or even disagreements that were anything more than trivial. Now there is anger sown, and accusations of deception, or worse. We are tearing ourselves apart.
The pain he felt pulsed like a raw wound in the Force. Luke felt it almost as his own, and he saw Ben wince a little as well.
We cannot serve in this way. Not when we are focused on our own hatred and fear and desire to be right. We must find resolution on this matter, and that, Jedi Luke Skywalker, and Jedi Ben Skywalker, is the only reason we permitted you to come.
You want our help in figuring out if this prophet was real or false?
Ben's voice conveyed his puzzlement.
We know almost nothing of your people, and the prophet is dead. How can we possibly help you?
You can touch the relics,
Tadar Ro said, his voice reverent.
We are forbidden to do so.
Luke remembered one of the bits of information they had learned about the Ang-Ti. They traveled the rift looking for artifacts regarding those who dwell beyond the veil. The data didn't specify whether these were artifacts created by the deities or if they were collected to please them. It is my understanding, Luke began, feeling his way cautiously, that your faith tells you to gather these relics. Tadar Ro nodded.
It is our sacred calling to do this. We find them and recover them and bring them here. It is through these items that we can perhaps determine the will of those who dwell beyond the veil.
They are of these beings?
We believe them to be, yes.
And yet, you can't touch them.
Again, Tadar Ro nodded.
It is blasphemy. Only infidels may handle them freely without offending those who dwell beyond the veil.
That must make it difficult to study if you can't touch them, said Ben.
It does. We have managed, however, to keep to both sacred laws, to gather and not to defile. We have enlisted aid from time to time.
Luke nodded, awareness dawning.
George Cardass, he said. Yoda sent him to you for healing, and you did so, provided he learned everything about you.
Once he understood us, he could aid us. He was very useful.
You knew him? Ben asked.
I did. I was sad when he finally departed.
And because of him, you were the one appointed to challenge us, Luke said, to see if we were worthy of handling your artifacts for you, so that we could help your people decide whether to embrace so profound a change in their way of thinking.
Yes.
Well, Luke said, it seems like we are in a position to help each other. Ben and I can peruse these relics and tell you what we find out. I give you my word that we will handle them with the utmost respect.
I know you will. I have been with you in the Force. Had I not deemed you able to behave so toward our most sacred items, you would not have survived your challenge.
Ben looked skeptical, but Luke nodded. If the Ang-Ti could flow walk, could alter time, it would have been quite possible to, as Gisela Horn had done, anticipate movements and kill the two Jedi on the inhospitable moon. Not to mention that the giant Sanhedrin ship they had initially encountered could have destroyed the Jade Shadow with ease.
In return, we would like for you to tell us everything you know about Jason Solo. Your impressions of him, what he learned, what he did here. I'm guessing that you instructed him.
Yes. Because of my knowledge of humanity through my interaction with George Cardass, it was thought best if I instructed Jason Solo.
And you will tell us of the time you spend with him then?
And teach me flow walking?
Ben blurted. Luke's head whipped around to stare at his son. Ben continued before Luke could interrupt.
I think that it's important that we learn all we can, Dad. I think if Jason knew something, some skill, some technique, we should too. We're trying to retrace his steps after all. Find out if it was during this journey that he started to go dark.
Luke remained silent. He knew that Ben had not protested when Luke alone was instructed in the Hasat Dur by the Baron Doe sages, because he had not been all that interested in learning the technique. This request was purely selfish, motivated only by Ben's curiosity. He opened his mouth to speak, to gently reprimand Ben, but Tadar Ro beat him to it.
We will accommodate both requests, he said.
Luke looked at him, surprised. Ben tried and failed to stop a huge grin. Luke felt disquiet stir within him, but did not say anything.
We wish you to feel that our side of this agreement is fully honored,
Tadar Ro continued.
Our word is dear to us. We will not willingly violate it, for to do so shows contempt for those who dwell beyond the veil. It is why we do not readily interact with other species, but...
he added, turning to look at each of them with those deep black eyes that seemed to stare into their souls.
We hold you to the same standard. You must do your very best to comprehend our ways, our culture, our faith. And you must use that comprehension to help us find our way back to a true path, wherever it might lead us.
We promise to help you to the very best of our ability, Luke said, choosing his words carefully. It was entirely possible, even probable, that he and Ben wouldn't be able to figure out anything useful. Luke could not promise to solve their problem, but he could vow to give it his very best effort. Beside him, Ben nodded.
We'll do our best, and thank you for agreeing to teach me.
Tadar Ro seemed satisfied.
It is approaching the time when we rest. Tomorrow, at first light, we will begin the sharing. Do you wish to stay here, or return to your vessel for the night?
We'll return to our vessel, thank you. But a question before you go, Luke asked.
Speak.
There are many items here that are designed for humans. May we take them to our vessel? The Yangti nodded.
If they will be of use to you, of course. I would ask that you not keep them, however, as they have become...
he floundered a little.
They are part of who we are now.
Luke inclined his head. I am pleased that one of my species is well thought of among the Yangti. We will return everything we take. You have my word. After Tadar Ro had departed, Luke turned to Ben. His son held up a hand.
I know what you're gonna say, Dad, but he said it was all right.
I didn't.
I know, and thanks for not putting your foot down.
Luke sighed and shook his head. You know how I feel about this, Ben, but I won't stop you from learning this if you really feel you must.
Ben shifted uneasily on the makeshift mattress.
I kind of feel like I do need to, Dad. I can't explain it better than that.
Luke didn't want to think that the Force was prompting Ben to do this, but it was beginning to seem that way. He knew that there were times when a parent had to let his children make their own choices, and their own mistakes. Ben had made his choice, and the Yangti had agreed to instruct him. It was out of Luke's hands now, and he chose to let it go.
I noticed there were a lot of data pads around here, as well as droid and ship parts,
Luke said, rising and changing the subject. Let's see if we can learn anything from them. They felt eyes upon them as they emerged from Cardass's house and headed back through the passageway to the Jade Chateau. Now that Luke knew what the situation was, the division of those who had regarded them with favor, or at least neutrality, and those who resented him made sense. It was unfortunate and awkward, but it was the situation. Luke only hoped that he and Ben would be able to find some sort of answers for them. When they returned to the Shadow, Luke began sorting through the data pads and other items they had brought with them, while Ben prepared dinner.
These are journals, he said.
It looks as though what Cardass was permitted to bring back with him was just the barest fraction of what he learned.
Maybe, Ben said. Or maybe it's just filled with ramblings along the lines of get me away from the rock creatures with the tongues.
Luke chuckled despite himself.
One way to find out, he said. He hooked up one of the pads to the holo receiver, and an image appeared. It was a human male, with dark hair and a short, neatly trimmed beard. He seemed hale and fit, and wore a shirt, pants, and boots.
If you're watching this, then presumably you too are a guest of the Yangti,
he said, smiling. The voice was deep, pleasant, and very familiar.
That's Tadar Ro's voice,
Ben said, as he came back with a tray of spice loaf sandwiches.
No, Luke said. Tadar Ro got his voice from Georges Cardass.
He snagged a sandwich. Let's listen to what he's got to say.
Chapter 16. Kesh, 2 years earlier.
Vistara's hands were tight on the reins as Tick flew toward the temple. He cawed and bobbed his head. Vistara turned her attention toward the beast who bore her, and sensing his discomfort, immediately relaxed her grip. Her thoughts had been so crowded that she had become distracted. She felt bad. Just like weapons and slaves, transport animals were valuable property, and the wise Sith did not abuse them without good reason. Two, Tick was more to her than an ordinary mount. She had bent him to her will, causing him to imprint upon her within moments of hatching, and she was fond of him. She shivered a little. At this altitude, she was paying the price for her choice of clothing in which to attend the council meeting. The delicate, almost flimsy material of her lovely green dress, while beautiful, offered no protection against the cold air and the wind that was starting to whip up. She didn't even have anything to put her hair up with, and it blew about wildly. Vistara placed a hand on Tick's shoulder, right in front of the saddle, and sent calm through the force. She then let the reins hang loosely about his sinuous neck and quickly began to braid her long, light brown tresses. She could do nothing about the dress. Some things would be sent to her from her home, she knew. As a Sith Saber himself, her father would decide what was necessary and appropriate. Everything else would be provided at the temple. Clothing, bedding, food, weapons. She would sleep in a dormitory with all the other apprentices, and very little would be truly hers alone. Once she had successfully completed her training and become a full Saber, she would be permitted to have a private room, and a blind eye would be turned on whatever luxuries she chose to fill it with. She would have earned the right to whatever vanities and indulgences she liked. Until then, though, Vistara would live a simple existence. The tribe did not scorn material goods, but first they needed to know that every Saber could live without them. She was not overly concerned with what would and would not be sent. At the moment, all she could think about was what she would learn. Vistara took up the reins again, gently directing Tick toward the dark stone spires that she could now distinguish from the rock out of which they had been carved. It was late afternoon, and the shade of the mountain's steep side fell heavily on the temple. There were no glow rods lit to gleam from the colorful glass windows, and even the white statuary in the courtyard seemed dim to her. She felt Ship before she saw him, swathed in purple shadows as he was, felt the now familiar and welcome probing, the soft swell of dark side energy emanating from him, distinguishable and unique, even when surrounded by the energy coming from the temple itself. Vistara felt her lips curve in a smile, and sent what she hoped was a respectful greeting. Using the pressure of her legs and adjusting the reins slightly, she guided Tick in toward the courtyard. Tick descended and landed with only a slight thump. Vistara slipped off, patting the UVAG absently. No less a figure than Lady Rhea herself stepped forward to take the reins. Vistara, horrified, looked around. There were several other apprentices, but none made as if to intercept the Sith Lord.
As I take the reins of your beast, so I take the reins of your life, my apprentice, said Lady Rhea. She gave Vistara a cool smile. There will be a formal ceremony later, but for now, we begin here.
Vistara calmed her thoughts.
She disliked being taken unawares, and she suspected that this was exactly why Lady Rhea had made this gesture. She bowed deeply, respectfully, in control.
"Of course, Lady Rhea. I submit myself to your guidance."
She met her master's eyes evenly, demonstrating her poise and confidence, honoring her teacher by indicating that Lady Rhea had accepted a strong young woman for her apprentice. Lady Rhea held her gaze. By sheer will, Vistara forced herself not to shiver as a particularly cold wind gusted across the courtyard, slicing through the pathetically thin material of her dress.
"Good. As you should."
Now Lady Rhea nodded, and another apprentice hurried forward to take Tick. As the Uvac lumbered off, wings folded against his sides, Vistara felt a sudden lurch. Would she be permitted to ride Tick at all? Or was he now property of the temple? Would he even be returned to her when she completed her training?
"Attachments are nothing to avoid in and of themselves."
Of course Lady Rhea had noticed.
"Indeed, passion is what drives us. But you must let go of the need to possess, Vistara. Anything that you have can be taken away from you. You come from a wealthy family, and you are used to having. Perhaps one of your lessons needs to be in not having."
She nodded to the apprentice leading Tick. The youth paused, drew Tick's head down, activated his lightsaber, and lifted it high.
"Tick!"
Vistara bit down on her tongue so hard she tasted blood. She kept her arms locked at her sides, swallowing the cry that had ached to be uttered. Her eyes were enormous, and she did not tear them away from the scene before her.
"Very good," Lady Rhea said, in a voice that was almost a purr.
Another barely perceptible nod of her white gold head, and the apprentice deactivated his weapon. Tugging gently on the reins, he led Tick down a ramp. The Uvac, blissfully unaware of just how close he had come to decapitation by lightsaber, followed compliantly.
"Had you protested, your Uvac would be dead now."
Lady Rhea's hand dropped to Vistara's shoulder.
"Go ahead and be fond of him, my dear, and of your pets and family and lovers you may take one day. Enjoy to the fullest all the trappings that power gives you, for you will have earned them. Want everything you wish. Hunger, burn for it, if that fuels you. But never love anyone or anything so much that you cannot bear to lose it."
For just a moment, Vistara was angry at the display and the brutal casualness of it all. And then she realized that Lady Rhea was right. Completely right. With that realization, the anger bled out of her, and she inhaled a hitching breath. Lady Rhea was watching her closely.
"My lady is correct, of course. I apologize for my reaction."